We're now going to proceed with the main body of tonight's archive show. This program will be entitled, or is entitled, and it will include part of last week's program as well, How the United States Lost the Second World War. This will go into the archives as Radio Free America program number 37. We're going to begin by taking a look at an article that appeared in the San Francisco Chronicle of yesterday. Actually, yesterday was August 1st, not July 31st. This particular article is by Michael Taylor of the San Francisco Chronicle staff. It is entitled, Lawyers Plan Mock Trial in JFK Death, subheaded Part of Bar Association Convention in San Francisco, and it reads in part as follows. Some of America's sharpest lawyers and judges will take a new look at the murder of President Kennedy in a high-tech, high-profile mock trial in San Francisco of alleged assassin Lee Harvey Oswald, replete with premises of new evidence in what one lawyer called, quote, the most investigated crime in the history of the world, unquote. Well, it is not the most investigated crime, at least not by the legal authorities. We'll see what happens in this mock trial. Skipping down in the article. The showcase of the trial will be the introduction of cutting-edge technical evidence developed by Failure Analysis Associates, a Menlo Park firm that investigates and analyzes disasters such as plane crashes or the collapse of offshore oil rigs. For example, engineer Jeff Lotz, L-O-T-Z, who will help the prosecution try to prove that Oswald was the lone assassin, said new enhanced inspection of the assassination movie taken by dressmaker Abraham Zapruder shows that the right lapel on the jacket of then-Texas Governor John Connally moved at the same time Kennedy was shot in the neck. Connally, sitting in front of Kennedy in the presidential limousine, was wounded in the attack. Lotz said this new information supports the hotly contested Warren Commission finding that one bullet, known by critics as the magic bullet, went through Kennedy and wounded Connally. Failure Analysis also fired a bullet through a skull filled with beef brain and covered with pig skin to analyze another point of argument raised by conspiracy theorists that the piece of film showing that Kennedy's head snapping backwards proves he was shot from the front. Oswald allegedly shooting from the Texas School Book Depository was behind Kennedy. Lotz said his investigation showed that when the skull was shot, quote, the motion of the head going back and to the left was consistent with a shot from behind, unquote, because the bullet created a shock wave in the brain that caused an explosion of the brains coming out of Kennedy's skull on the right. This made the head go back and to the left, Lotz said. As anyone who has heard me discuss the assassination of President Kennedy knows, the single most important thing about examining this particular historical event is to understand the historical forces at work. I do not think there's a great deal of value at this stage of the game in running around the grassy knoll and counting bullets and cartridge cases. However, I do think it's important for the uninitiated, particularly young people, to be aware of just how ludicrous the Warren Commission's thesis was. The Warren Commission thesis is not only wrong, but the evidence or the allegations by engineer Lotz notwithstanding, it is physically impossible in all of its major respects. The Warren Commission could not admit that more than three shots were fired in the 6 seconds that Lee Harvey Oswald had to shoot. One shot exploded Kennedy's head, one shot missed the motorcade completely and wounded a bystander named James Tague on the ricochet. That left one bullet and one bullet only to account for all seven non-fatal wounds in Lee Harvey Oswald and Governor Connally. In addition to the fact that that bullet would have had to have made several sharp turns in mid-air without being acted upon by an external force in direct contravention of the law of inertia, the fact of the matter is that the bullet residua taken from those seven non-fatal wounds allegedly made by the same bullet exceeds the amount of material missing from that bullet. There's a basic principle of mathematics. The whole is equal to the sum of its parts. The sum of the parts cannot be greater than the whole. Therefore, the entire Warren Commission thesis is down the drain. End of story. The entire thesis is completely ridiculous. The rifle allegedly used by Oswald has never been linked with Lee Harvey Oswald in any hard sense, and in fact, the testimony of Marina Oswald was manipulated by some of the same Galen elements we'll be looking at this evening in order to help frame her husband. Beyond that, the rifle was sighted in for a left-handed shooter. The scope was sighted for a left-handed shooter Oswald, who was a lousy marksman to begin with, was right-handed. He wouldn't have been able to hit the motorcade at all. We can go on from there. But the Warren Commission thesis is absolutely ridiculous, and engineer Lott here can present all of this supposed evidence, such as Connolly's lapel moved. Well, his wrist didn't move at the time, and it was supposedly being shattered by a bullet. This is the ultimate example of someone jumping on a dime or dancing on a dime. And I think the alleged evidence that will be presented by Failure Analysis Associates and Jeff Lotz, all of that plus a dollar will get you a one-way ride on the average municipal transit system. We will be looking at some of the physical evidence this evening. The entire Warren Commission hypothesis is ridiculous on its surface, so do not pay a whole lot of attention to this particular mock trial if, in fact, as I suspect, the verdict will be that Lee Harvey Oswald was guilty, the lone nut assassin. And I wouldn't pay a whole lot of attention to engineer Lotz and Failure Analysis Associates. I think what we can expect from this is lots of failure and damned little analysis under the circumstances. We're going to begin this evening by reviewing some of the information that we looked at last week in the first part of what will be included in the archives as Radio Free America program number 37. Now, I began by examining an article that was authored by Anthony L. Kimmery, last name K-I-M-E-R-Y, in the current issue of Covert Action Information Bulletin number 41. This article is entitled George Bush and the CIA in the Company of Friends, and Covert Action Information Bulletin issue number 41 is the summer 1992 issue. For those of you who would like to subscribe to Covert Action, and it is the best periodical available on the subject of the U.S. intelligence apparatus, Covert Action Information Bulletin is at 1500 Massachusetts Avenue, Northwest, number 732. That is in Washington, D.C., 20005. Again, Covert Action Information Bulletin, 1500 Massachusetts Avenue, Northwest, number 732, Washington, D.C., 20005. And I would strongly recommend that you not only pick up number 41, but subscribe to the publication. It's a quarterly, and you will save money by subscribing rather than picking it up at the newsstand. Now, in this particular article, Anthony L. Kimmery cites compelling circumstantial evidence, though not absolutely conclusive, that in fact George Bush, who supposedly first joined the CIA when then-President Gerald Ford, a key Warren Commission member, appointed him as Director of Central Intelligence in 1976. In fact, there is, as Kimmery presents, substantive evidence that George Bush was operating for the CIA probably from the days of his graduation from Yale. What we looked at in that particular article, reviewing, the Ivy League and Yale University in particular was a hotbed for CIA recruiting in the immediate post-World War II years, and a fellow named Alan Skip Waltz was in all probability the individual who recruited George Bush into the CIA. George Bush's father, Prescott Bush Sr., a Yale graduate, was not only a member of the Transatlantic Financial and Industrial Axis that we looked at in the archive shows, in an addendum to the archive. Well, actually, we looked at in the archive shows and also added an addendum some months back. The Uncle Sam and the Swastika broadcast deals with the active cooperation between U.S. industrialists and financiers and those of the fascist powers of Europe, including the Third Reich. Prescott Bush Sr. was part of that transatlantic financial and industrial axis, and I use the term axis literally here. In addition to being a patron of Yale, he also was a very close friend of William Casey, an OSS veteran. The OSS, the Office of Strategic Services, was America's World War II intelligence service, a precursor of the CIA, and William Casey became the director of Ronald Reagan's 1980 campaign when George Bush was vice presidential candidate. And there are indications that both Bush and Casey may have been involved in the October surprise. By the way, I would recommend the book The Old Boys by Burton Hirsch. Casey, of course, became director of the CIA under Ronald Reagan and was deeply involved in, among other things, the Iran-Contra scandal until his untimely demise in 1987. He had a fit, or he collapsed, and in convulsions just before he was going to testify before Congress. Next, Anthony Kimry goes on to set forth circumstantial evidence that, in fact, George Bush's work on behalf of the petroleum industry also involved his work on behalf of the CIA. One of the people who was instrumental in introducing George Bush to a company called IDESCO, a subsidiary of a petroleum firm, a petroleum engineering firm called Dresser Industries, D-R-E-S-S-E-R, that individual was Henry Neal Mallon. Mallon, in addition to being, like George Bush, a member of the elite Skull and Bone Society from Yale University that itself is deeply involved with the CIA, or has been over the years, Henry Neal Mallon was a close personal friend of Alan Dulles. Alan Dulles was a key OSS operative during the Second World War. William Casey, by the way, was in charge of secret intelligence for the OSS in Europe. Alan Dulles, of course, went on to become director of the CIA. Dulles himself, as we looked at in Uncle Sam and the Swastika, a key element of this transatlantic financial and industrial axis. Dulles was fired by President Kennedy and later served on the Warren Commission allegedly investigating President Kennedy's death. One of the interesting pieces of information that is documented by Anthony L. Kimry was that George Bush worked with George de Morenshield. George de Morenshield was a white Russian, a director of Nobel Oil, and an individual who had spied on behalf of Nazi Germany during the Second World War. De Morenshield had worked closely for a period of time with Baron Konstantin Meidel, last name M-A-Y-D-E-L-L. Meidel had been in charge of all Abwehr activities in North America for a period of time during the Second World War. The Abwehr was German military intelligence. Many of the members of the Abwehr II group, for a time headed up by Meidel, were recruited into the Reinhard Gehlen organization after World War II. And Kimry maintains, and he makes a good case, though not an airtight one, that the relationship between George Bush and George de Morenshield may very well have been that of agent and intelligence handler. Both men were in the petroleum industry, and both men, in all probability, were deeply involved. Well, de Morenshield certainly, and Bush probably, involved in using their work on behalf of the petroleum industry for intelligence activities on behalf of the CIA. One of the points that Kimry makes is one of the pieces of information he presents is testimony by unnamed former intelligence operatives that, in fact, George Bush had been deeply involved with the CIA, and specifically after Fidel Castro came to power in Cuba and nationalized the Cuban oil industry, George Bush and the CIA were very active to help destabilize Castro to attempt to get their fingers or their hands back on that Cuban oil. It is a matter of public record, and we went into that last week, that George de Morenshield was deeply involved in the Cuban oil exploration business. It was maintained by some of these unnamed former U.S. intelligence operatives that, in fact, George Bush's Zapata Oil Company was used as a front for some of the CIA's anti-Castro activities. And, of course, as we have looked at in the Guns of November programs dealing with the assassination of Kennedy, the CIA's anti-Castro Cuban milieu was deeply involved in the assassination of President Kennedy. The assassination was not done by the CIA, but elements of the CIA and the FBI were involved, necessitating a cover-up by both institutions. After that, we took a look at how the Mexican oil industry was nationalized by Mexico, and they began turning to, among others, the Soviet Union for assistance in developing their oil resources. This was an even greater alarm to the CIA, and both George de Morenshield and George Bush appear to have been deeply involved in CIA activities to keep the U.S. petroleum industry's fingers deeply into the Mexican oil development situation. I also, we took note of also that George de Morenshield was very active on behalf of a subsidiary of Brown & Root. That company was not only deeply involved with the developing the political career of George Bush, but also the political careers of Richard Nixon and Lyndon Baines Johnson as well. Bush used Dresser Industries again as an apparent cover for his CIA activities, and Bush and his Zapata company got a handsome economic reward from the Mexican petroleum industry. We also took a look at a piece of information which is contained in a miscellaneous archive show called George Bush's Political Resume, namely that George Bush was apparently dispatched to gauge the reaction of the anti-Castro Cuban exile community in Miami to the assassination of President Kennedy. We are going to take a look later in the broadcast at how that particular community behaved. Following that, we took a look at the apparent long-term relationship between George Bush and Theodore Shackley, a key CIA operative. Bush was ambassador to China at the time that Theodore Shackley was in charge of the CIA's Far East Division. Then Bush became director of Central Intelligence and appointed Shackley associate deputy director of operations, one of the most important areas in the CIA. Then George Bush became vice president, was apparently involved in aspects of the Iran-Contra scandal, and Theodore Shackley, the supposed ex-CIA agent, in fact was operating as well in the Iran-Contra scandal. Following that, we took a look at Gerald Ford, again a key member of the Warren Commission. He appointed George Bush director of Central Intelligence, and in that capacity, George Bush was instrumental in frustrating congressional probes of possible CIA connections to Oswald and Jack Ruby. I would also note, too, that there are numerous other ways, and numerous other areas in which George Bush crops up in connection with the investigation of Kennedy's assassination. For one thing, it was George Bush who alerted the FBI to a young Republican from Houston who Bush felt may have been involved in the assassination. In my opinion, this was probably an attempt by Bush to lead the investigation astray. Certainly, it would have been necessary for a Kennedy assassination insider, and Bush was certainly involved with elements and with the milieu that was involved with the Kennedy assassination, even if he himself was not. It would have been essential to have an insider as director of CIA while Congress was probing CIA connections, possible CIA connections to Oswald and Ruby, as well as when the House Select Committee on Assassinations was formed in 1976. I would also note that George Bush, a director of Zapata Oil, was the person who owned the building in which Jack Ruby's Carousel Club was housed. And we also took a look at connections between George Bush and Dusty Miller, a key Teamster operative, a member of the Teamsters Union, who also was in contact with Jack Ruby. Jack Ruby phoned Dusty Miller shortly before the assassination of John Kennedy. After that, we took a look at a section from the aforementioned manuscript by Dr. Peter Dale Scott, namely Government Documents and the JFK Assassination. We took a look, both in that document and from the book High Treason, to which we will be returning this evening, at the involvement, or the almost certain involvement, of George de Morenschild with the Third Reich's intelligence activities. We also took a look at something that we will be taking a look at much greater length this evening, namely the fact that Lee Harvey Oswald, who had supposedly defected to the Soviet Union and betrayed to the Soviet Union top secret information not only about the United States North American radar defense nets but about the U-2 project, how when he returned to the United States he not only wasn't arrested for treason but he was met upon his return not by the FBI or CIA but by a fellow named Spaz T. Rakin, R-A-I-K-I-N, and Rakin was the Secretary General of the American Friends of the Anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations. The latter, the ABN, an organization put together by Adolf Hitler in 1943, and we will be talking about that at great length this evening. We then took a look at the intelligence community, CIA, and petroleum industry milieu, of which both George Bush and George de Morenschild were part, and we took a look at their profound role, their pivotal role, in handling the Oswalds in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. We will be returning to that at considerable length this evening. Following that, we took a look at George de Morenschild's role in attempting to develop the Cuban oil industry. Obviously, when Fidel Castro nationalized the Cuban petroleum industry, that brought that to a head. So what we're looking at, what we began looking at last week, and what we're going to be looking at length and in detail this evening, is a milieu involving the petroleum industry, the intelligence community, the Galen organization, or elements involved with and closely connected to it, We're going to be taking a look at the assassination of President Kennedy, and we will be looking at this evening the forces, the political forces which had formed and which were instrumental in killing President Kennedy, how they performed in connection with the Kennedy assassination, and also how they have affected the world that has come out of that tragic event. We're going to begin, first of all, by taking a look at some sections, reviewing in detail some sections from a long section of the Dallas Conspiracy that I read last week. We were limited for time, but I'm going to review some of those. Once again, the Dallas Conspiracy, also authored by Peter Dale Scott of the University of California at Berkeley, for my money, one of the preeminent political intellects in the world today, a truly brilliant individual. In the beginning of Chapter 3 of the Dallas Conspiracy, now bear in mind, again, we're going to be taking a look at the petroleum industry, the intelligence community, the considerable degree of overlap and cooperation between them, and in turn, the involvement of many of these Soviet émigrés who worked for the Galen Organization. We'll be taking a look at their involvement with this milieu, and we will be taking a look at the pivotal role that they played in handling the Oswalds. Now, again, bear in mind that Lee Harvey Oswald was demonstrably innocent. The importance of examining this particular milieu is to understand the nature of the forces that were at work to overthrow the government of the United States. The assassination of President Kennedy was very important in a number of different respects. It represented, as we looked at in our Aryan Nation series, the culmination of a decades-long constitutional struggle between the military, who've never liked the idea of having a civilian commander-in-chief, and the executive branch. That was resolved on 11-22-63 in favor of the military. It also represented, as we will see, the triumph of the rollback or liberation theory of fighting the Cold War over the containment theory of, once again, fighting the Cold War. But beyond that, and even more importantly, it represented the coming of fascism to America, or the triumph of fascism to America. It also represented, in a very real sense, as we will be examining during the course of the archive show this evening, the end of the Second World War, and the Axis won, and the Allies, including the Red, White, and Blue, the U.S. of A., lost. And if that seems like a preposterous claim, just stick around and examine what we're going to be going through this evening. The first section of the Dallas Conspiracy that I'm going to review this evening begins, "The case that Oswald was an agent is strengthened by the paradoxical condition of poverty and privilege in which the Oswalds lived after their arrival in Texas. Though he severed all contact with his family after Thanksgiving 1962, and though he seems to have made not one single friend otherwise, Oswald and his wife Marina were now favored with the attentions of a small circle of wealthy Russians and their friends, connected almost exclusively with the politically influential petroleum engineering industry." This next couple of sentences indicates, actually, the next two sentences indicate just how central this petroleum engineering industry milieu, these white Russians, were in handling the Oswalds. Bear in mind that Lee Harvey Oswald was supposedly a welder, a handyman, a warehouse worker. Let's see just how instrumental these people were in handling the Oswalds. "The Warren Commission's list of 34 persons, quote, with whom Lee Harvey Oswald may have had contact, unquote, many of whom met Oswald for only a single evening, is striking testimony that Oswald's social life was entirely governed by his Russian patrons. Every single person on this list, as well as some others whom the commission did not include, had been met by the Oswalds through these patrons. This includes the alleged liberal Ruth Payne of the ACLU, who assumed the same babysitting role between mid-April of 1963, the time of the Walker incident, and November 22, 1963, when relations between the Oswald family and the Russian community were temporarily suspended. This Russian community, by no accident, had links with wealth, petroleum, the political machines of both parties, government, and above all, intelligence activities. Take, for example, the first two people whom Oswald contacted, allegedly in his search for someone in Fort Worth who spoke Russian. Of the two, the Russian-born Peter Gregory, G-R-E-G-O-R-Y, a petroleum engineer, was a personal friend of Mike Howard, one of the two Secret Service agents who isolated Marina Oswald in the days after the assassination. We shall see that Howard used Gregory in his interrogation of Marina, and that Gregory abused this responsibility by significantly distorting what Marina said. Well, again, note who it was that this supposed traitor to the United States and avowed Marxist was hanging out with. He was hanging out with about as diehard an anti-communist group of people as possible. They were all very, very wealthy, very socially prominent, and here was a supposed welder, greaser, and warehouse worker being trafficked around by these people. Also note, and we're going to come back to this because the Walker shooting is going to be one of the major elements in our analysis this evening, take note that from mid-April of 1963 until November 22, 1963, this Russian community in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, again, deeply involved with the intelligence community, severed all contact with the Oswalds, which is incriminating in and of itself. It indicates a conspiracy because the information that Lee Harvey Oswald supposedly shot at Edwin Walker supposedly did not surface until December 3rd, 1963. So this sudden severing of contact between this very influential petroleum and intelligence and Galen-linked milieu is a very, very interesting phenomenon under the circumstances. Also take note that these same white Russians, these same Galen-linked elements, were instrumental in extracting false testimony from Marina Oswald. We're going to come back to that later. And bear in mind, too, above all else, that George Bush, currently President of the United States, former director of the CIA, was not only an associate of George DeMoranshield, but was obviously deeply involved with this same petroleum and intelligence milieu, if not in fact, and he may have been involved in the assassination of John Kennedy itself. The next section of the Dallas conspiracy that we're going to review this evening begins. One of the chief Russian guardians, George Buhe, B-O-U-H-E, was a 60-year-old personal accountant for Lewis McNaughton, capital M-A-C, capital N-A-U-G-H-T-O-N, of the famous oil exploration consulting service DeGolyer and McNaughton, a man with numerous CIA contacts. DeGolyer is spelled capital D-E, capital G-O-L-Y-E-R. Continuing. Buhe was said actually to have been, quote, rather mad at Marina for taking an apartment at Oak Cliff because it was rather too far for him to drive and help her when she needed help with the baby, unquote. Lee Oswald, who worked in this period as a welder, greaser, or handyman, was also driven to parties and otherwise cared for by a member of the Dallas Petroleum Club and World Affairs Council, Count Sergei DeMoranshield, who knew Jackie's family and who admitted working with French intelligence during World War II. Recall, as we saw last week, that was actually German intelligence unless he was working with the fascist Vichy French intelligence service. Continuing. DeMoranshield, a key witness in corroborating Marina's story that Oswald shot at Walker, and bear in mind here again, interrupting, that DeMoranshield was instrumental in corroborating Marina's story, beginning again, DeMoranshield, a key witness in corroborating Marina's story that Oswald shot at Walker, also had numerous political and CIA contacts. He was accustomed to do business on a personal basis with such prominent backers of Lyndon Johnson as George Brown of Brown and Root, the firm whose lawyer, Charles Francis, helped save Johnson's Senate election in 1948, and John Meekum, M-E-C-O-M. And in a footnote to the passage about Lewis McNaughton, and bear in mind the DeGolyer and McNaughton Corporation, because that's front and center here, a petroleum consulting service, an oil exploration consulting service of the CIA contacts of Lewis McNaughton and the milieu he was involved with, Professor Scott adds in a footnote, for example, McNaughton was a director of Republic National Gas and the Republic National Bank in Dallas with Carl Hoblitzelle, H-O-B-L-I-T-Z-E-L-L-E, who set up the CIA conduit Hoblitzelle Foundation. Skipping down, one trustee of the foundation was Sarah T. Hughes, H-U-G-H-E-S, the judge who, on November 22, 1963, administered the controversial oath of office to her friend and patron, Lyndon Johnson. Now, note that both McNaughton and Hobetzilla were directors of, among other things, the Republic National Bank. That bank was owned by Texas oil billionaire H.L. Hunt, one of the prime movers in the John Birch Society and the American far right. We will be taking a look at the Hunt establishment, both H.L. and his sons, later on in the broadcast. And in another footnote to the passage about George de Moronshield working with, among others, Brown of Brown and Root, we already touched on that in the Kimry article, Professor Scott adds, George Brown was president of the Brown Foundation, a CIA conduit. A director of Brown's firm, Texas Eastern Transmission, was a trustee of the CIA conduit San Jacinto Fund, whose founder was John Meekum, again M-E-C-O-M. A third director of Texas Eastern, George A. Butler, B-U-T-L-E-R, was trustee of the CIA Conduit Hobby Foundation with Mrs. Ovita Culp Hobby, H-O-B-B-Y, who sat on the CIA's Cuban Freedom Committee with the aforementioned Peter O'Donnell, Jr. According to Evans and Novak, the Brown brothers, quote, became Lyndon Johnson's personal vehicle for a lateral movement into the center of the new oil power, unquote. And of Peter O'Donnell in the previous footnote, Professor Scott says, the president of the Hobetzilla Foundation was Peter O'Donnell, Jr., a Goldwater Republican who sat on the National Advisory Council of the Young Americans for Freedom with Robert Morris. By the way, Robert Morris was a former key aide to Senator Joe McCarthy. He also was General Edwin Walker's attorney. By the way, take note of John Meekum here. Again, last name M-E-C-O-M. John Meekum is the former owner of the New Orleans Saints of the National Football League. Now, again, take note of the intersection here between the intelligence community, the petroleum exploration industry, the milieu that was behind the political fortunes of Lyndon Johnson, and take note, again, of the fact that George Bush was deeply involved with this particular milieu. Now, remember again, de Gaulle and McNaughton, bear in mind that McNaughton, along with Carl Hobetzilla, was the director of the Republic National Bank. That is H.L. Hunt's, that was an H.L. Hunt property. And bear in mind that Hobetzilla set up a CIA domestic funding conduit, one of whose trustees was the judge who administered the oath of office to Lyndon Johnson on 11-22-63. She was a Johnson protege. Bear in mind, as I said, that George de Moronshield helped to corroborate Marina's story that Oswald shot at Walker. We'll be taking a look at that later. And again, bear in mind de Moronshield's operations on behalf of Brown and Root and Texas Eastern that we looked at in the Kimry article. And bear in mind that Brown and Root were deeply involved not only with the backing of Lyndon Johnson, but also Richard Nixon, whose probable participation in the assassination we looked at in The Guns of November Part 3 and an addendum that I did in late June. Bear in mind they were also deeply involved, that is to say Brown and Root, with the political fortunes of George Bush. And as we've seen, Brown and Root, too, inextricably linked with this petroleum and intelligence milieu that we're looking at this evening. The next section of the Dallas conspiracy that we read last week and that I want to review this evening begins as follows. Before April, the avowed Marxist Oswald was cared for by the old guard Russians. These were mostly aristocratic and united in their nostalgia for the ancien regime, in contrast to the more recent and plebeian post-war émigré. Differences between these two emigrations produced two separate Russian parishes in Dallas during the 1950s, each claiming to be more anti-communist than the other, but divided on the issue of what to do about the, quote, liberation, unquote, of Russia. Bear in mind liberation, because liberation or rollback theory is front and center in this program. Continuing. To judge from their testimony, the old guard, even if czarist in their nostalgia, echoed the policies of the American CIA establishment of which they were indeed part. The new arrivals included Ukrainians and other non-Russian Soviet minorities, and some of them, although less aristocratic, were ideologically more right-wing and revanchist. At least two of the new arrivals were far to the right of de Moronshield, one of them described in one breath as a, quote, leftist and as, quote, an Eisenhower Republican, unquote. Unlike all the other Russians investigated by the commission, these two men, Ilya Mamontov, M-A-M-A-N-T-O-V, and Igor Voshinin, V-O-S-H-I-N-I-N, are said to have made a point of never meeting the Oswalds before the assassination. Yet it was their circle, rather than the old guard, which adopted Marina thereafter. The two Russians who did not meet Oswald are even more interesting than the rest who did. Igor Vashinin was a member of a worldwide Russian organization called the NTS. In English, usually called either the National Alliance of Solidarists or the National Toilers Alliance, a semi-covert organization working closely with revanchist elements in West Germany, with the Asian People's Anti-Communist League and Kuomintang in Taiwan, and, at one time, until the pro-Ukrainian ABN drove them out, with the Latin American CIADC and their proposed World Anti-Communist Conference for Freedom and Liberation. Continuing with Scott's essay, although there is little research on the NTS, they are known to have been founded in 1930 by a group of émigrés, nearly all engineers, in Belgrade, Yugoslavia. Many of the Russians who came to Texas after World War II had lived in Serbia, including Vashinin himself, an engineer. During the war, many of the NTS collaborated with the Nazis, and particularly the Nazi Liebrandt in Rosenberg's Ostministerium, who accepted the Solidarists because of, quote, their ideological proximity to fascism, unquote. As such, they ran a training camp for the Nazis at Wüstrau and later supplied the right wing of the Russian forces grouped briefly by Himmler under the turncoat Russian general Vlasov, V-L-A-S-S-O-V. By the way, Wüstrau is W-U-S-T-R-A-U, and Liebrandt is L-E-I-B-R-A-N-D-T. Rosenberg is Alfred Rosenberg, a key Nazi party official, deeply involved. He himself was a Baltic German, deeply involved with Third Reich policy towards the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe. Now, in this particular passage that I just reviewed, there are several important things to take note of. First of all, remember the organization NTS. That is an organization, again, of anti-Bolshevik Russians. It worked deeply with the Third Reich. It also then worked with the U.S. intelligence apparatus, the CIA in particular. It became a key component of the Galen organization, and bear in mind that Igor Vashinin was a member of this particular organization. He, along with Mamontov, was one of the white Russians, or white Soviets, I should say. They were not all white, not all Russian, who were involved in handling Marina Oswald after the assassination. That handling of Marina Oswald was front and center to being able to fabricate her husband's alleged guilt. I would also note, too, that the NTS is one of the two major Third Reich Soviet émigré organizations that worked with the Galen organization and with our own intelligence system, and we're going to be taking a look at the operational methodology of the NTS and the operational goals of the ABN, which conflicted with it, although it worked with the NTS in the Third Reich, and also when the Galen group jumped to the CIA, we will see that there is a fundamental difference in their orientation towards how to handle the defeating of communism. The NTS basically sought to preserve the territorial integrity of the old Russian Empire, simply driving out the communists, whereas the ABN sought to break up the Soviet Union, or the former Russian Empire, into its constituent ethnic republics. As we will be seeing, what we saw in the abortive August coup of 1991, in which the Soviet Union and the Communist Party of the Soviet Union collapsed, was a fulfillment, in all probability, of the methodology of the NTS, the tactical operations favored by the NTS, and the goals of the ABN. As we shall see, one of the major things that the NTS advocated was appealing to the elite cadre of the Soviet Union, in particular the military, and the NTS was apparently deeply involved with a successful infiltration of the GRU, Soviet military intelligence, and they advocated as a means of overthrowing communism, stimulating a revolt in the Red Army. Also note, too, that Vashinin and Mamontov had made a point of never meeting the Oswalds until after the assassination, when they met Marina. And note, as I cited earlier, that between mid-April of 1963 and 11-22-63, this Russian Galen CIA community in the Dallas-Fort Worth area severed all contact with the Oswalds. And again, it was on April 10th of 1963 that Lee Harvey Oswald supposedly shot at Major General Edwin Walker. The next section of the Dallas conspiracy that I'm going to review. And again, we read this last week. Once again, turning to the NTS, of particular interest in the story of Marina Oswald are the repeated stories that the NTS had succeeded in planting agents inside the Soviet Union, particularly in the Army, a fact which may or may not have something to do with the known penetration of Soviet Army intelligence, the GRU, by the CIA. The NTS, along with its Ukrainian enemies in the anti-Bolshevik bloc of nations, also collaborated closely with the efforts of the APACL in Taipei, where the NTS maintains permanent representation, to establish the proposed World Anti-Communist Conference for Freedom and Liberation, until the NTS was excluded by a coalition between Catholic Ukrainians and anti-communists from Latin America. During the Hungarian uprising of 1956, for example, the Asian People Anti-Communist League's message of support was transmitted to Hungary via the services of the NTS Radio Free Russia. This makes it likely that the NTS was also in contact in Texas with the allies of the APACL and through them with the John Birch Society and the supporters of General Walker. Neither Voshinin nor his friend Ilya Mamontov was asked whether he belonged to the NTS. Mamontov spontaneously denied being a member of the John Birch Society, even before de Morenschild had suggested that he was, while singling out him, rather than Voshinin, as the one excessive rightist of the Russian community. He was, however, a geologist, that is to say, Mamontov, he was, however, a geologist with the Sun Oil Company, whose owners, the Pugh family, have in the last few years given well over $1 million to right-wing organizations such as the Christian Freedom Foundation. The excessive rightist Mamontov, who never met Oswald, was, however, the one Russian who personally knew the alleged liberal Ruth Payne, apart from his mother-in-law, who was her tutor. And it was Mamontov who was the first Russian to renew the community's contact with Marina some 5 hours after the assassination. He had been called by telephone to serve as interpreter at the first questioning of Marina in the presence of their mutual friend, Ruth Payne. It was not, however, Ruth Payne who had first contacted him to interpret, but, quote, Mr. Jack Crichton, C-H-R-I-C-H-T-O-N, a misspelling, by the way, a petroleum operator, quote, connected with the Army Reserve Intelligence Service, unquote. The commission did not pursue the question of why Mr. Crichton or Army Intelligence should have been involved in the Oswald affair. If they had, they would have learned that until 1962, Mr. Crichton was also a vice president of the Empire Trust Company, a firm whose leading shareholders, the interrelated families of Loeb, L-O-E-B, Lehman, L-E-H-M-A-N, and Bronfman, B-R-O-N-F-M-A-N, are said by Stephen Birmingham to have maintained, quote, something very like a private CIA around the world, unquote, to protect their other investments such as in Cuba, in Guatemala, and in General Dynamics. We shall soon see that Birmingham's allegations, Birmingham's allusion to the Loeb, Lehman, Bronfman, quote, private CIA, unquote, is corroborated by the mysterious intervention of Jack Crichton in the Oswald case, and that the proper choice of Marina's interpreter was crucial to the development of the case against her husband. Mr. Crichton's example also shows that such a private CIA, of which there are many in the world of high finance, does not compete against existing intelligence and law enforcement agencies, but infiltrates and works within them. Thus, Crichton was simultaneously an Army Reserve intelligence officer and an employee of Empire Trust, one of whose directors was Bowie's and Ford's employer, Lewis McNaughton. Crichton himself had been a vice president of DeGolyer and McNaughton from 1946 to 1950. Crichton, moreover, had not only intelligence but political connections. In 1964, still an Army Reserve intelligence officer, he ran unsuccessfully against John Connally as Republican candidate for governor of Texas. By the way, the Ford here is not Gerald Ford, but a fellow named Declan Ford, another member of the white Russian community in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, the Galen-related element that was instrumental in handling the Oswalds, also connected with DeGolyer and McNaughton. Now, in this particular section, again, note the NTS, one of the two major Galen elements that we're going to be looking at, that we are looking at this evening, and note significant indications that it had been instrumental in penetrating the GRU, Soviet military and intelligence. Bear in mind, too, by the way, I should have mentioned at the top of the broadcast that these two monographs, both the Dallas Conspiracy and Government Documents in the JFK Assassination, were authored in 1971 and 1972, respectively. There is a lot more information on the NTS now, so we will be turning to that later. There is also a very significant question about the possible, and I say possible, handling of the Oswalds inside of the Soviet Union. This is, as I like to say, food for thought and grounds for further research. But in addition to their obvious handling of the Oswalds in the United States, the Galen-related elements and the NTS in particular, which apparently was involved in a successful penetration of the GRU, they may have been involved in handling the Oswalds inside of the former Soviet Union. Now, note again that the NTS was part of the World Anti-Communist Conference for Freedom and Liberation. It worked for a time with the anti-Bolshevik bloc of nations, about which we shall have more to say later. And note again that, as we shall return to later, the NTS, as well as the ABN, was apparently in touch with the John Birch Society and General Walker.